The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Thanks one and all for joining me today. I am delighted to welcome Atlantic staff writer Helen Lewis joining us from Great Britain. Thanks so much for being here, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
I've been a fan of your writing for quite some time. You bring, first of all, a great deal of information, but also a calm detachment about some of the most contentious topics that roil our politics. So congrats to you for that.
Well, I can't take full credit for that. I have a brilliant editor, Dante, who represses my natural instinct to be slightly snarky and mean and tries to turn me into a proper, you know, Atlantic. The idea at the Atlantic is we have to conduct ourselves with a spirit of generosity, which doesn't come particularly naturally to me, but I'm working on it.
Well, great. Maybe we'll get glimpses of that in this conversation. So I also just want to get a sense of where you grew up and how you got interested in the topics that you are. You're the author of Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights. So tell us about your upbringing and what got you interested.
Sure. I grew up in the 80s and 90s in Worcester, which is a small city in the middle of England. And I think it was an interesting place to live. It is a classic bellwether state. It's too long covering American politics. Sorry, a classic bellwether city and constituency. In that, the time I was growing up, it was conservative, and then it in 1997 when Tony Blair came in, it switched to being Labour, and then it was Labour all the way through until 2010 election, which was the first one that Labour lost, and it switched over to being David Cameron's Conservatives. Then it stayed conservative all the way up until last year when we had a Labour government again, and sure enough, Worcester turned Labour. And I think that's a really great training for politics. Also, my parents are Catholics. My dad is a deacon in the Catholic Church. My mum was a religious studies teacher and a biology teacher. I've been an atheist for quite a long time now. But I think one of the things I think is a really good training for journalism is enjoying being around people who aren't like you, and also being at ease with places that are kind of borderline, liminal. You know, I was in Pennsylvania for the last election, and it was really genuinely a privilege to talk to so many people with such a range of different opinions, and to have to kind of sit with that. I think, you know, particularly with the internet, it's very tempting to retreat into the citadel where everybody agrees with you and you're the righteous ones. But actually, as an intellectual discipline, forcing yourself to talk to people who brings just completely different life experiences to the table is something that you must absolutely do. So yeah, that's me.
Okay, that's really interesting. So you say you're no longer a Catholic, but did being raised as a Catholic, I know in the past, being an English Catholic was very much having an identity as a minority. Did it still when you were growing up, or was it not very important?
Not really. I mean, they even let Catholics marry the heir to the throne now. There's no more establishment honor that you can bestow. No, and I went to a Catholic school as well. So actually it was, you know, that everybody there was, I know, I went to mass twice a week. You know, I was not living a minority life. Not in the way that you would do if you grew up Jewish in Britain, for example.
Right.
But, you know, I think it was very useful because it taught me the kind of value of community. You know, even now, I just talked to my mum at the weekend for Mother's Day here, and she was off to go and give Sacrament of the Sick, Holy Communion, to somebody who doesn't get a lot of visitors, is basically housebound. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up with my parents with that kind of ethic of the idea of kind of caring for other people, and then the idea of a life of service. And now that, you know, journalism is a lot flashier and more narcissistic than that in a lot of ways. But, you know, I'm the youngest of five, and we've all ended up doing things in some respects that have some kind of idea beyond just, you know, you should make lots of money. My brother and my sister are both doctors. My other sister, who's an accountant, is a governor of a special needs school. So, the way that I try and think about journalism is, you know, and it's not always, as I say, I'm quite snarky and mean a lot of the time, but it is a discipline that I think, you know, contributes to a healthy, thriving democracy, you know, that level of kind of disagreement, and also people being in possession of the facts. There is a kind of moral purpose behind it without being too pompous, I hope.
Yes. Now, recently you had a piece about the effect that the second Trump term is having on the sort of global populist movement. And there is a world in which you could have imagined that Trump would be seen as the leader of this global populism, that he would give encouragement to it, and that it would thrive all the more. It's not as if there aren't lots of little mini-me's around the world, that he could sort of be the leader of. But you say something else is going on, so tell us about that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that his popularity and his particularly his stance on Ukraine has proved to be a problem for European populists. Not all of them. Viktor Orban in Hungary is fully signed up, you know, loves him, appears at lots of the kind of, you know, intellectual backing of MAGA conferences like the National Conservative Conference, that kind of thing. You know, Belarus, which is also quite Russia-aligned, also doesn't have a problem with Trump. But I think if you look at both Marine Le Pen, who, as we're speaking, is just not has been barred from running for office for the next 5 years, but nonetheless a very significant figure in the history of what was once the National Front and is now National Rally, the far-right party in France. She kind of cautiously stepped away from Trump's Ukraine views. Giorgia Meloni, a populist right leader in Italy, has also been relatively quietly critical and distanced herself from them. The only other people who really have kind of embraced them are the AfD. Now, Alternative for Deutschland in Germany. They did very, very well by historical standards in the recent German elections. They're very strong, particularly in the east of the country. But they didn't have the kind of massive breakthrough that I think some of them were hoping for. And they're still locked out of government by the kind of cordon sanitaire that the other parties hold. So there is a kind of feeling that the Trumpian level of populism doesn't really quite translate to Europe in the way that I think probably is sort of naively assumed by people like Elon Musk, who was, you know, hyping up the AfD a huge amount before polling day. And that's because, frankly, you know, Russia is right next to us. You know, the Baltic states have particularly complicated histories with Soviet rule in the 20th century. You know, I was in Riga in Latvia just before the year, and you know, they have the museum that is dedicated to what was the FSB's torture prison, where you can go mm-hmm. and see all of the bullet holes in the walls from where they just pulled people out of the cells and shot them. You know, these are countries that have deep histories of concern about Russia. And so Trump's kind of pro-Russia friendly turn is not that appealing to them. You know, they you know, they may have their disagreements with the European Union, which is a very imperfect institution, but they do see themselves as having turned away from Russia in the 20th century and been quite happy with that in lots of cases. You know, and another example would be Nigel Farage, who is an incredibly successful populist leader. In America, he's probably best known for that picture of Trump, you know, with Trump in front of the gold escalator. The gold elevator. And he's like Mr. Brexit, you know, he, through his successive parties, UKIP and then the Brexit Party and then Reform, he's been a presence in British public life for the last two decades. Now, just before Christmas, he had a falling out with Elon Musk. Elon Musk said that he, you know, it was up to Nigel Farage would have to admit a guy called Tommy Robinson, who's an anti-Islam campaigner and a rabble-rouser with numerous convictions for violence, very much hyped up by people like Jordan Peterson and other people on the American kind of online right. You know, Nigel Farage had to admit this guy for the first time into his party. That was the future of the right. And Nigel Farage said, no, I absolutely refuse to do it. I've always refused to do it. I have always said in my parties, which are populist right parties, I will not admit people who have been members of racist parties like the British National Party. And what's really interesting about that is I looked at some polling just yesterday, and sure enough, polling about Elon Musk in Britain is fascinating. So Labour voters, Liberal voters, Green voters, people on the centre and centre-left, basically all loathe him. Tory and Reform voters, so people on the right, were, you know, could see some upsides to him. And then you see January, which is when he falls out with Nigel Farage, and those numbers just fall off a cliff. And basically, given the choice between Nigel Farage's style of right-wing politics and Elon Musk's style of right-wing politics, British voters almost universally want Nigel Farage. And he has a very clear sense of where the limits are, you know, and what things are overtly racist and will repel people versus what things people see as being legitimate concerns around immigration or whatever it might be. So that, you know, I think that the MAGA prescription obviously has come to power in America. How popular it will be in power is another question. I think you're already seeing some dissent at town halls, and you know, the withdrawal of Elise Stefanik from an election suggests that they're not confident about holding on to seats that they won quite, you know, quite well in November. But you know, it is at the moment, it just is not working across large amounts of Europe.
It does sound as if having a strong feeling of UK envy here, because it does sound as if even people on the right in Britain are able to make distinctions, that the polarization madness has not gone so far as to make people just accept anything if it comes from their own side.
I think there's more fluidity of voters, and that's a really healthy thing. You want to live in a country with lots of swing constituencies and lots of swing voters, people who are going to make their decision about who they're going to vote for based on the competence and quality of the leadership that they're being offered, not on really tribal grounds. I mean, the way I think about it, about a place that has in some respects quite dysfunctional politics within the UK, is Northern Ireland. And that was, for a long time, people voted purely on sectarian religious lines. You voted for the Catholic Party or the Protestant Party. And it's actually, I think, been healthy for Northern Ireland. There's been the growth of parties like the Alliance, which are, you know, non-sectarian, because actually that means that if you have one, you know, very bad or corrupt leader on one side or the other, there's somewhere for their voters to go that isn't as, you know, as impossible and unthinkable as them as voting for the other side. And I think America has got too much of that thinking, really. And as you say, it is polarization is what we now call it. If you are in a state where you are Republican to the core and there's nothing that Donald Trump could do to make you not vote Republican, that's actually quite a bad situation for a democracy to be in, because it means he can act with total impunity. And I think that's certainly how Donald Trump thinks of it. We'll see whether or not that's true.
Speaking of impunity, you had another piece about the Tate brothers. So Andrew and Tristan Tate you can tell our listeners, but they are a pair who were being held in Romania. I don't think they were in prison, but they were at the time they were not allowed to leave the country. And then under pressure from the new Trump administration, they were permitted to travel back to the United States. This is almost a textbook case of what happens with excessive polarization, where, in fact, your headline kind of says it all. When you may not have written it, I know the author frequently doesn't write.
No, I'm going to take credit for this one because I think it's quite good.
Yeah. Okay, when you're MAGA, they let you do it. So tell us about Andrew Tate and his execrable brother, and the story behind this. What's going on?
Yeah, I thought this was a real test of seriousness of principle on the American right, which I have to say we'll come to it. But some of the people passed. Some people spectacularly failed, but some people passed as far as I'm concerned. Andrew and Tristan Tate are dual British and US nationals. They had a black American father and a white British mother. And they grew up in Luton, which is a kind of dormitory town around London. And Andrew was a reality TV contestant. He was an MMA fighter. And he's always kind of wanted to be famous. But the latest way that he got famous is that he ran something called Hustlers University. And this was essentially a kind of, let's be honest, a pyramid scheme, which was
online
courses.
Truth in advertising, honestly.
Well, I mean, the fascinating thing about Andrew Tate is that he just says out loud things like, There's a voicemail recording of him saying to one of his girlfriends at the time, "I love raping you." I mean, this is not a subtle man, right? And he is overtly misogynist. He says you have to beat women, you have to treat them like dogs. You know, his brother says many similar things. And, you know, so they had this Hustlers University, which was essentially defrauding young men by giving them worthless online courses and encouraging them through affiliate schemes to sign up their friends and their followers. And the
Sounds
same
familiar,
time,
by the way.
Well, yes, Trump University might not be a million miles away from that. But and at the same time, they were running a sex trafficking ring, allegedly, in Romania, in which they would encourage women to come over, you know, shower them, love bomb them, tell them they were going to be their girlfriends, and then put them to work running webcams. So there's accusations from over three dozen women about this. And that's, as you say, they were under arrest awaiting trial in Romania, under house arrest. But then it's very hard to work out exactly what happened. It's one of those ones where Trump sort of went, this is the first time hearing it, for me, who? Much as you might remember from Signalgate last week, when he sort of went, a messaging app.
Knew nothing about it.
Right, yeah. Exactly. But his special envoy, Richard Grenell, appears to have had some conversations with the Romanian government, so according to the Financial Times. And then it was announced that the Tate brothers were free to leave. So they headed for Florida, sort of inevitably in the American pantheon, like where you would end up. Florida seems like one that would be their destination. But the interesting thing is what happened next, because actually you had people like Jeremy Boring, who's just stepped down at the Daily Wire. You had Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, you know, and James Uthmeyer, his attorney general, saying, you know, these people are just pimps and crooks. Like, what are we doing here? And I, you know, Ben Shapiro from the Daily Wire spoke out as well. So there was it was one of the few things I've seen that has presented a kind of crack in the facade of some people just going, why are we going out to bat for these grotesque preachers of hate who have no, you know, traditional religious values? On the other side, there are people like Tucker Carlson did a very sympathetic interview with Andrew Tate saying, you know, he was fighting against his feminized culture and he was a great redress to it. Or Alina Haber, who was on a podcast and she said, you know, you guys are just like Trump. He's being persecuted too. And yes, it's one of those things where it's if I supported Donald Trump, I probably wouldn't say, you're just like these sex trapping rapists who run a pimping hose degree. I think that's quite an offensive comparison for Donald Trump. But you know, apparently, according to Alina Haber, they're very much similar. Anyway, the odd thing about it is that they've ended up going back to Romania, which is the weirdest thing about it.
Oh, they've gone back?
Yeah, so I think possibly because Ron DeSantis did look very much like he was interested in prosecuting them. Also, a girlfriend of Andrew's has now accused him of beating her up in the US and sued him in
choking,
the US.
And choking her.
And exactly all the same things that we've heard from so many other women, that he said, I own you, and he was violent to her during sex. So, after saying we're free from this benighted hellhole of Romania, they've gone, I think I'll take my chances under house arrest rather than ending up in a supermax in the US. Thanks.
If you're like me, you've noticed that getting older is full of little wake-up calls. You start seeing more hair in the drain, your part looks wider, and suddenly you're zooming in on old photos, wondering if your hair was always this thin. That's why I'm really loving what OneSkin is doing. Their OS01 peptide has been transforming our skin here at the Mona Charon Show for a while. Now, with their new scalp serum, OS01 hair, it's here to help us with hair loss, thinning, and shedding. Why would a skincare company create a scalp treatment? Well, because the scalp is skin. And just like the rest of your body, it experiences cellular aging. But instead of wrinkles, it messes with your hair follicles and natural growth cycle, leading to hair loss and thinning. OS1 hair is the first scalp serum powered by OneSkin's OS01 peptide, which targets those aging cells called senescent cells, and it's scientifically proven to help your hair cells do what they're meant to do. Grow denser, fuller, healthier hair. Get to the root of hair loss and thinning with OS01 hair. You'll save 15% on your first purchase with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. Two things I'm really into are healthy teeth and healthy hair. So this is very important to me. Founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists, OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. Get 15% off with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at OneSkin.co with code MonaCharon. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you. These are criminals. They are monsters. They are hateful. But that really doesn't matter to a certain kind of MAGA fan, because they are appealing to a distorted, a perverted view of masculinity. And Tucker Carlson, little bow-tied, you know, Tucker, goes on the air and says, Tate's view is that men want respect above all. It's how they're wired, he said. In order to get respect, men must become worthy of it. They must become more impressive. Wake up early, work as hard as you can, stay sober, find God. That's Tucker Carlson's explanation of the Tate appeal. I mean, it is nothing remotely like what Andrew Tate is.
I find it really, I find it fascinating. It's like you kind of want to go, I mean, I wouldn't choose to spend my time consuming Andrew Tate's content, but I have done in order that I can write about him. And presumably if you're interviewing him, you must do too. So are there other good videos? But tell me, I find Tucker Carlson one of the most fascinating figures on the right. You must have been aware of him for a really long time. What explains that evolution from bow-tied, beloved bow-tied Fox News host Tucker Carlson to sort of demon-obsessed man in a cabin?
I wouldn't presume to read his mind, but my sense is it is a combination of cupidity and craziness. So I think there is, you know, like Elon, not unlike Elon Musk, who I think has become a little addled, perhaps in his case by drug use as well. There was a piece in Your Own magazine about what happens to people who are heavy users of ketamine, or even mild users of ketamine, that it really does affect your judgment. I don't know that that's the case with Carlson, but it's clear that he is, you know, extraordinarily online. And I think that's possibly warped his judgment. But also, look, I mean, it's been great for his bottom line.
Great for business.
It's been good business. So I guess those two things. And of course, if you don't have a conscience, then there are many more options open to you.
Yeah, his tour. I found his tour during the American election fascinating, because one week he would have, you know, J.D. Vance on, and mm-hmm. the next week he'd have Russell Brand, another alleged British sex offender who's taken refuge in Florida, leading everybody in prayer. And like, I remember Russell Brand when he won an award called Shagger of the Year. And then he found various different types of God, he just seems to me like the most obvious example of somebody who has kind of cycled their way through different versions of all of them. The commonality is that people should listen to Russell Brand. And I think in his case, it's probably narcissism. Whereas I think you're right, maybe there's something slightly more cynical in some of the other people on that bit of the American right, where they see themselves as entertainers and they don't really have any boundaries. They just want to hear everybody who's got an interesting story to tell. And if that's a guy who's going to claim that he had a crack-addled affair with Barack Obama, then, and it's people are doing ratings, then why not toss it into the, you know, toss the chum into the water?
Well, that's right. And the entire ecosystem is so different now that, you know, the incentives are all perverse, right? I mean, there was a time when, so one person who Carlson also highlighted during that same period was a Holocaust denier, who Carlson lauded as a great, you know, independent historian, etc. The bravest, you know, that sort of thing. Now, there was a time when that was enough to get you considered just beyond the pale, and you would lose your audience and you would lose your legitimacy. Now it powers your rise. It will get you clicks. It will get you attention and a certain kind of rabid follower. And that's power now. So the incentives are very, very unhealthy.
You're right. There is a certain kind of, if it's making the libs cry, then by definition, it's good. Which I think you're right. That was Martha Maid, wasn't it? Daryl Cooper, who said that he thinks that the real villain of the Second World War is Winston Churchill.
That's
which
right.
is a kind of fascinating line of argumentation, because there's a very strong left-wing critique of Winston Churchill over, for example, the Bengal famine. But
right.
This is something that Carlson has come back to, saying that, you know, actually it would have been better for Europe if Hitler had won, because Europe is now lost. And you're like, I don't think it would have been better for Europe's Jews if Hitler had won, like just as a first starting
Or many
place.
Others, yes.
Yeah, or
yes,
Roma,
yes.
or gay yes. people, or, you know,
gay
the mentally
people.
Disabled.
Right, right. Yeah.
But you're right. There used to be a line, and now the line is imaginary. The line is gone. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So another topic that I want to turn to that you've been great on is the whole subject of trans sports, trans people participating in sports, and trans identity, and all of that. And I love what you've written because. Because you're able to step back, perhaps being British is part of it, just you, your good judgment.
Right.
But In our country now, it is so polarized that, and honestly, I mean, so I have a somewhat, I have a skeptical view of trans treatment of children, and I'm worried about there not being adequate science, et cetera. But I am aware that there are these people on the right, like Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, who are doing the most extreme things in the name of, you know, skepticism about trans people, that it verges on cruelty. It's ignorant. It's hateful. If you are skeptical about the whole project of the affirmative model of treating children who have dysphoria about their gender, then you risk being seen in the U.S. as sympathetic to the people like Abbott, and it's such a trap. It's so hard. And most people just, they say, okay, I'm just not touching it. I'm not going there. It's too dangerous. It's too toxic. I know I will be misunderstood. And it is so frustrating. And that's why I want to talk to you, because you are like a cool glass of water on the issue.
Well, you say that, but you're entirely right. There are, I mean, I'm on several lists of, you know, known TERFs, known transphobes, which is not a characterization that I accept. I mean, I think it sounds like I'm in the same place as you are. And I'm sure you get these accusations too, that you want, you know, you don't believe that trans people exist. You're denying their humanity, or,
right.
You know, you want them to die. You've got blood on your hands. And I just think this is, you know, it's one of the reasons that, you know, sorry, I only smile because we moved directly from Holocaust denial to transgender issues. So we're just going to circle through all the most controversial issues of the day. But, like, you know, I just feel quite strongly that the positions that I hold, you know, so again, cautious on puberty blockers, but I also believe that these children are in genuine distress and they deserve, you know, appropriate support and treatment. You know, I believe that people who are gender nonconforming are not freaks. There's a huge amount of gender nonconformity throughout history. And I don't like that the rhetoric of the executive orders is deeply unhelpful.
Agreed.
You know, and how are you, if you want to convince people who've been through these treatments that they're wrong, I think describing them as mutilation is kind of, it's ultimately pretty unhelpful. But those are positions that are held in all the surveys suggest by the majority of Americans. The majority of Americans are skeptical about puberty blockers and extremely skeptical about underage surgeries, which are rare but do happen. And, you know, the Biden administration, Rachel Levine, who was the highest ranking trans official, intervened to have lower age limits for surgeries taken out of the latest WPATH guidelines, which is the American association that governs the standards of care. So there is a real problem there. And there is also a majority, you know, we talk about the silent majority and people laugh along with it, but that is the case here. If you look at all the polling, most Americans don't think that post-pubertal males belong in women's sport. They think they have an advantage and that makes it unfair. Most Americans don't think that you should be offering mastectomies to 14-year-olds, which is something that hospitals have done. A surgeon called Steve Gallagher in Miami makes TikToks, or used to make TikToks, about yeeting the teats. You know, there's a huge area in the middle of moderate consensus that says, okay, so we can accept that adults should have huge latitude to decide their identities themselves, but puberty is a one-off physical process, and if you interfere with it, you can't redo that. And we should treat, you know, anything that attempts to interfere with extreme skepticism. But you're right. It's very hard to make those arguments. I think you're right. Being British is an advantage. I don't think it makes me cooler. I think it makes me more secure in the fact that we have come to an understanding here in Britain, along with the Scandinavian countries. You know, the idea is that talk therapy is the first line treatment for gender dysphoria in children. That's something that Finland, you know, who I don't think anyone would describe as an anti-LGBT country, have decided. Sweden has decided. Then the idea is here that puberty blockers are currently banned outside of a clinical trial, which is going to take some time to set up. But the idea is that we just don't know what the effects of them are. We don't know what the side effects are. We don't know how beneficial they are.
But we do know that there are certain warning signs. For example, bone density. Problems with bone density, apparently, one of the things that happened, not apparently, it's known, one of the developmental processes that the body goes through for boys and girls in puberty is tremendous strengthening of the bones. And if you delay that and that or interfere in it, there is no way to get it back, even if you start cross-sex hormones after puberty blockers.
Yeah. I mean, I've been following the Scametti case at the Supreme Court, which is due to return in June. Now, that was brought by the ACLU and the Biden administration to challenge Tennessee's ban on blockers. The Trump administration has now withdrawn from that, but is allowing the case to proceed. And the really interesting thing about that was that Chase Stranger, who is the lead lawyer for the ACLU in that, conceded in front of the court that there isn't any good evidence that puberty blockers are life-saving, which is the rhetoric that has just been used, and the one that is used to say that people like me want trans children to die.
Talk about that a little more. You're referring to the fact that for a very long time, trans activists have said that if you deny affirmative treatment, including puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and social transitioning to children with gender dysphoria, they will kill themselves. And the classic thing was to say that, to parents, do you want a live daughter or a dead son?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a lot of reason to think that the suicide risk is actually not, I mean, the Tavistock study found that it's actually not true.
Well, the Tavistock, to its credit, had a note on its website for a long time now, for going on for a decade now, saying, you know, we don't talk about this because actually suicide among children is incredibly rare.
Right.
Adolescent suicidality is higher. So there is an important distinction here, which is the difference between suicidal thoughts and ideation and completed suicides.
Yes.
And what there really isn't any evidence at all of is the idea that denying people puberty blockers causes completed suicides. So Wes Streeting, the British Health Secretary, ordered a review after the Tavistock was banned from prescribing puberty blockers to say, let's look at the population and let's see whether or not suicide has actually risen as a result. And Lewis Appleby is a very senior and respected psychologist, did that analysis and found absolutely no difference. What I think muddies the waters is the fact that the Dutch protocol, which was the original wave that developed for this treatment, was on children who were otherwise psychologically quite well adjusted, quite well supported,
yes,
at home, but had,
yes,
gender dysphoria and had,
yes,
it from early childhood. But the population has moved, and now the kids that are turning up at gender clinics, they might have a developmental disorder. They might have, you know, ADHD or autism. They might have eating disorders. They might have
trauma. In fact, a huge percentage of them have comorbidities.
Yeah. Right. And so those kids are already more distressed from other stuff. And what we haven't really been able to sort out is their distress all being caused by the gender dysphoria? And if we fix that, everything else is fixed. Or is the gender dysphoria one of many ways that their distress is showing? And I think it's been really interesting the way that trans activists have been very reluctant to have any mention of anorexia or eating disorders in this conversation. My friend Hadley Freeman wrote a brilliant book called Good Girls, which is about her own experience as a teenage anorexic. She was sectioned, which she fought very hard to have a chapter in that about gender dysphoria, because some of the recent cases have followed a very similar pattern to anorexia, which is a sort of sudden development of acute distress with the body in biological females around puberty and a real desire to have some control over that and to arrest puberty. And it's quite telling to me that in one of those groups, if it's girls who are starving themselves so they don't have breasts and go through puberty, we say, this is not something that we should affirm. And another group who say, I don't want to go through puberty and have breasts because I think I'm a boy, the idea is that you should just not ask a secondary question. You should kind of, you know, give them, you know, Reuters investigation found that there were places that were handing out testosterone at a first appointment.
Correct.
And I think that, you know, that the reason that was such a taboo thing to mention was it did provoke big questions in people's minds, like, why aren't we absolutely asking whether or not the affirmative approach is the right one? But yeah, I think it's been a really difficult subject to cover for exactly the reason that there was a kind of, I mean, emotional blackmail makes it sound too strong, because I don't think people were being malicious. I think people genuinely believed that they were saving children's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very powerful emotional, you know, feeling to have and to try and put aside. But there is, as you say, no evidence for it.
Most people don't realize how much of their personal information is out there and how hard it is to get it back under control. Your name, address, phone number, even your online activity, it's all being collected and sold without your consent. That's what fuels the spam, scam calls, and real threats like identity theft. And while it is possible to remove your data, the process is deliberately confusing and time-consuming. It's not designed for people to succeed on their own. Privacy Hawk helps cut through that. It tracks where your data is being shared, works to remove it, and keeps watch so you don't have to. Privacy Hawk gives you a simple way to take control of your personal data. It scans data broker sites to find out where your information is being shared and works to get it removed. And it keeps monitoring and alerts you if your data shows up in a breach or on the dark web. If something does go wrong, you're covered with up to $1 million in identity theft insurance and expert help to recover. It works in the background so you don't have to manage opt-outs or chase down data brokers on your own. If you care about privacy, security, and having a little more control in a system that offers very little, this is a practical way to take action. Honestly, before hearing about this, I hadn't really thought about my online privacy. I mean, I knew there was a lot out there, but I hadn't thought about, you know, you don't necessarily want people to be able to get a hold of where you live or lots of other personal stuff. So this is very helpful. You can try Privacy Hawk by running a free privacy scan at goprivacyhawk.com/Mona Charon. Use the code uppercase Mona20 on iOS or lowercase Mona20, all lowercase, on Android to get a discount on the Platinum Annual Plan. That includes up to $1 million in identity theft insurance, alerts for data breaches and dark web activity, ongoing removal of your personal data from broker sites, and expert support if you ever need help recovering. So again, to be clear for both of us, there are children who present from a very young age as trans. They say, you know, when you talk to people who are trans, they will say they knew from a really, really young age that they felt like they were in the wrong body. The advent, though, and this is what causes a certain amount of worry, is that in recent years, so for decades, as long as records were kept, the overwhelming majority of trans patients were boys, natal boys. And then a few years ago, that flipped. And now it is overwhelmingly, or not overwhelmingly, but predominantly females. And they are reporting these feelings at much later ages, again, as puberty is threatening.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's something that ought to be in a world in which we were going by science and not by ideology and not by a medical fad. We would say, well, hold on, we need to get a grip on why this is happening. How much of it is a fad? How much of it is being driven by online influencers? Quite a bit, as it turns out, according to many surveys. And, you know, what is the harm in waiting? You know, there are trans physicians and others who have specialized in the treatment of trans individuals who have urged caution, saying, you know, you have to do a thorough evaluation of each patient about everything about his or her life, whether they've been sexually abused. In many cases, that is in the histories as well. Whether, you know, they've had a big loss in their lives, all of these things, whether they're being bullied at school. And until you do a thorough evaluation, it's medical malpractice to simply say, well, the affirmative model here is what we will do. We will call you by the other pronouns and we will prescribe you puberty blockers and then cross-sex hormones. And let's talk about also, you know, the fact that there are other instances in history when science has figured out how to do something and before it understood all the implications. And, you know, you think of lobotomy.
The one I think a lot is the kind of ice pick lobotomies. Yeah. And again, driven by the same, just think people with very severe epilepsy, for example, and that, hang on a minute, this is great, we found a cure. And then you see there were cases like whichever Kennedy it was, the daughter who was treated like that and then had to spend the rest of her life in an institution. You know, science can overclaim because it's done by humans. And that, you know, thalidomide is a treatment for morning sickness in pregnant women, which then led to limb deformities in their children. You know, these are not stories that require evil people. And I think that's the kind of thing that sometimes liberals really struggle with. A system in which everybody is doing their best and thinks that they are improving the sum of human happiness can actually end up having unintended consequences. But the other thing, you're right to bring up the change in population. I mean, I, you know, I consider myself a feminist, so I think about this from a feminist point of view. But we're, you know, lots of medical treatments were developed and designed for men and male bodies. And, you know, clinical trials often exclude women, saying menstrual cycles, how can we possibly account for that? How does it work? But what's interesting about the puberty blockers is that is very obviously a treatment that was developed for biological males, because male puberty is this incredibly strong and, you know, androgenizing event. So, you know, you are becoming taller, hairier, broader, your brow is becoming more prominent, your adam apple is developing, you know, all of these, you know,
your voice deepens.
And once your voice is deepened, you can't shorten those cords again. You can't, you know, there's a lot of training for trans women that they try and do to speak more breathily, which just takes out those lower tones. It's not a process you can unwind. So if you want a natal male to pass as a woman in the way that, say, Kim Petras does as a singer, you know, someone who's been on puberty blockers, Hunter Schafer, you know, Elon Musk's daughter, you know, that group of people, there was a very strong clinical rationale. That doesn't actually apply so much to girls, because even if you give testosterone to a natal female, they're never going to reach adult male height. You know, it is not the same kind of process. So it just feels like it was a treatment developed for boys that was then ported to a completely new population of girls. And that's, you know, that's something that I don't think really gets talked about. I think one of the things that's really interesting is that we have these conversations about gender and they end up always being conversations about sex. You know, one of the things that winds me up most is when we're talking about trans inclusion in sports is that that's not about banning trans kids from sports, which is often what it said. It's about banning biological males from the female category. And the example that I always like to cite is the same college swimming season that Leah Thomas at UPenn was causing such a kerfuffle by as a biological male, had previously raced as William, now racing in the female division. There was a trans guy called Isaac Hennig, who was biologically female, wasn't on testosterone, but had a mastectomy, who was competing in the male league. And no one cared, not a single person cared, because he had no competitive advantage.
There was no unfairness.
If anything, he was at a competitive disadvantage by having a female skeleton and VO2 max and all those kind of things. Yes. So what we're really talking about in sporting terms is the advantage that male puberty or male external hormones. And when you take, if you take testosterone for other reasons, that is considered a performance enhancing drug. So, of course, you would expect somebody who takes testosterone or whose body naturally produces far more testosterone than a female body to have an athletic advantage. And so, I just think the whole framing of that conversation irritates the hell out of me, because nobody objects really to trans men competing in male sports. They may be very ill-advised to do so for safety reasons, but they're not causing unfairness to other competitors.
So there's the fairness issue. There's the fad worry. There's the fact of the huge sudden surge of natal females who are presenting as trans, which hasn't been fully explained or understood. There is also the fact that though it's frequently presented as benign, and that, you know, all of these, I was at a meeting with a trans activist once who was saying everything, it's all reversible, but that is not true. These things are not reversible. And these decisions about, so if a child, now again, you know, there are certain kids for whom this is probably the way to go, certain small percentage, but as you pointed out in your work, 8 out of 10 children who present as trans, once they go through puberty, they lose that identity and identify as their birth sex. The number may be even higher. There's a little bit of confusion about that. But the other things that happen when you prescribe puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones is most of these kids are going to be anorgasmic, or what's the word? Not they will be unable to achieve orgasm.
Yeah, that Marcy Bowers, head of WPATH, admitted that if you blocked puberty before, I think it was Turner stage two, then you're going to never develop fully, you know, develop
gametes. Explain what Turner stage two is.
So Turner stages are the stages of puberty, and you can essentially work out, you know, it's the development of adult genitalia, or body hair, of those kind of things. So if you block puberty at a sufficiently early stage, exactly, you're right, then those kids are never fully sexually developed and never fully fertile. And, you know, some of these treatments also reduce fertility. So there is some talk about whether or not you should kind of give counselling to children about that and offer them egg or sperm preservation. These are very heavy decisions to be making before you're even in America allowed to drink, you know, that you will have to decide exactly whether or not in 20 years' time you want to have kids or not, let alone the idea that you want, you know, you want to pass as a woman so much that you are prepared to be essentially sexless for the rest of your life. You know, I think these are extraordinarily deep ethical questions. Even as you say, whichever way you land on whether or not they should be allowed, they should be considered in extreme depth.
And when you're dealing with a troubled kid who has a lot going on in his or her life, is confused, anybody who's ever been a parent knows that children go through phases I'll broaden it out. Anybody who's ever been a child or an adolescent knows that, you know, people are changeable. They may have very vehement feelings at a certain point about something and then later change their minds. And the detransitioners are a whole category of people, tend to be undercounted in some of the official data because kids who stop getting, for example, puberty blockers frequently don't report back to the clinic that was prescribing them and, you know, say that they have decided against this course of action. But in any event, they testify that, you know, they wish they had gotten better counseling before they made these drastic and irreversible decisions at a young age when they're way too young to know what they're going to want later in life, like whether they're going to want to become parents.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not comfortable saying anything about the number or rate of detransitioners or even desisters. You know, it's people who start engaging with services and then just, as you say, drop out for one reason or another, for the simple reason that no one has really been doing that research in a systematic way. There's a very brave researcher, a trans man himself called Kinnan McKinnon, who's started to try and look at some of it. But it's been something that the kind of LGBT movement has kind of thought, said, this is, you know, this is just a moral panic and no one should be looking at this, and this will only be used to discredit us. And I don't think that's really particularly helpful. There was something that Lisa Sellin Davis, who writes a good Substack on this issue, pointed out, which is that for lots of people's medical insurance, there are codes, insurance codes for transition. There are no insurance codes that cover detransition. And that's a problem. If you decide you want to get your mastectomy reversed, for example, then suddenly your medical provider is no longer interested. And that's been the effect of suppressing kind of research on detransition. My hunch is that those numbers actually are full bore, I regret this, detransition will be quite small, because it is essentially like, you know, being a priest and then losing your religion, in the sense that you will lose not only your community, because you'll be seen as a kind of traitor and an outcast, but also a tool of the kind of evil right-winger sphere. So I think people who sort of predict there'll be huge waves of detransitioners might be overcounting them. But as I say, actually, we have no idea of the numbers, because clinics don't keep particularly great records. Part of the CAS report, which I think you alluded to earlier, this report by Hilary Cass in the UK into gender services, she asked the adult clinics to give her all of their data, and they refused. Because presumably that reason, that we think it will be weaponized against us. You know, Joanna Olsen Kennedy, who's done a lot of research into transgender medicine, has testified in favor of transgender medicine in lots of court cases, told the New York Times that she wasn't going to publish some of her survey data because she feared it could be weaponized. And so we have got this intensely politicized science. And this comes back to what we were saying right at the start, which is, in the face of everything that Trump and that White House is doing, people on the other side of the argument just don't want to hear. They don't want to hear from you and me that there are legitimate concerns, and European countries are quite queasy on this, because they just see it as, do you stand with trans kids or against them? And I sort of reject that framing. I want children with gendered distress, whatever their eventual life path to be, to get the best possible care. But people just say that's concern trolling, they're not interested. You know, they don't want to. I think some of it is to be quite brutal, intellectual laziness of not wanting to, you know, the number of times that somebody will regurgitate an activist talking point to me that I've heard a million times before, like the one that comes up all the time in sports is that the Republicans want genital inspections of teenagers. And you go, the way that we sex test is a cheek swab followed by a blood sample. I mean, if people are passing laws to do genital tests on teenagers, then that's, there's no scientific reason for that. That's just something that is sort of a hobby for them in their spare time, and we should obviously be opposed to it.
As you mentioned, a number of European countries, not known for their anti-LGBT posture, the Nordic countries, also France, Britain, have pulled back from the affirmative model of treating this and have said, you know, puberty blockers only in very rare circumstances and, you know, a careful evaluation of the whole child, which seems very, very sensible. But in the United States, there, since the Trump administration came in, one of the awful things that they are doing is, among so many, is they're just slashing research into anything to do with trans kids. So, great. Now we won't have any data on which to base a scientific assessment, right, of what works, what doesn't, what's helpful, what's unhelpful. Just if it has the word trans in it, they're against it. They are using this for the most transparent political reasons. They're trying to make, they're trying to demonize trans people and to and just to make them into other, you know, into an enemy class.
You're right. It's pure vandalism. I went and looked up, you know, the famous Trump most recent thing about, you know, they're even making mice transgender or whatever it was that he said.
Yeah.
I went on to look at what the research he's talking about is. And there is an NIH funded grant that is about giving hormones, sex hormones to mice. And you would give testosterone to mice in order to study its effect on the heart. Now, one of the things we do think is that maybe a lifetime on testosterone, if you're born biologically female, might have some, you know, it causes vaginal atrophy, it causes a number of other side effects. One of the things it might possibly also do is affect heart health. You know, men have heart, far more heart attacks than women. There is something about estrogen that does seem to be protective of the heart. So actually, mm-hmm. this is a, like, if you're worried, if you think that these people have been, whatever he wants to call them, mutilated by science, the one thing that you would probably want to do is do good research into ways that we might ameliorate that. But no, yes. You're right. What's happened is that the Doge chainsaw has come down. They've done a simple keyword search, and then suddenly anything that smells of woke is, you know, up in flames, up in chainsaw-based flames. I'm not sure that metaphor works. but it's right. It's just, it's completely anti-science. And the way that it sounds like you've been talking about the way that I've been talking about this is about actually what the science shows. And the Trump administration is not interested in that at all.
Not at all. Let's talk about a couple of more aspects of this that I think need to get more attention. One is the number of kids who are gay who show up at gender clinics. So it's not easy, even now, even in 2025, it isn't easy to be gay. And it's concerning to me and to some gay people who've spoken out about this, Andrew Sullivan very prominently, that they're afraid that kids who are gay may show up at gender clinics and be sort of channeled into the trans treatment modality when really they're just same-sex attracted.
Yeah, I talked to Katie Herzog, you know, of Blocked and Reported podcast about this. She wrote a piece that was essentially saying kind of where have all the lesbians gone? Because she found that so many people that she knew in the scene around Seattle, Portland were now either non-binary or trans men. And I said, like, come to Britain. We still have butch lesbians here.
Yeah. Right?
But I think it's really hard to be a butch lesbian in the same way it's really hard to be a very effeminate gay man. That brings you in for a lot of social mockery. And actually, that's one of the things that I find most fascinating about this is that we're sort of encouraging people to become more gender conforming just in a gender that they've switched over to. If you're taking boys who are very feminine and turning them into girls, and girls who are masculine and turning them into boys, that's not actually that liberating of people from the boxes that they were in to start with. So I think, yeah, I think that's, you're right. I think that's what really turned Andrew Sullivan onto this as an issue. It's been a big driver of, you know, and it's, I think, caused a pretty profound split in the LGBT community, both in, more in Britain, really, because it's more in the open, but I think sort of more subtly in the US too, between particularly an older generation that said, hey, I thought we were fighting for the idea that you could be anything you wanted to be in your birth sex, and younger people who see transitioning as liberation. And those are just two fundamentally conflicting visions. But you're right, the evidence suggests that a hugely disproportionate number of the children turning up at gender clinics report same-sex attraction. And that also, if they don't proceed to transition, then lots more of them would grow up to be gay and lesbian. So you do have to really worry that what we're doing is actually retrograde and stigmatizing children who, if not given drugs, might suffer significant gender dysphoria. This is one of the things that really surprised me about the Cass report, is she said not only that she thinks that most gender dysphoria resolves through puberty, that is itself the mechanism by which people go, oh, okay, there's, you know, I could just be a girl who wants to be an engineer and wears trousers, you know. But also the idea that she was against even social transitioning, because she said it just put people on this one-way path. It never gave them a chance to actually explore their gender in an open-minded way. And, you know, I find it really tricky when I see those parents and they say, we knew she was a girl from the age of 4 because she put a princess dress on. And maybe there's more to it than that. But also maybe everyone in your family went, oh, our boy's wearing a princess dress. And your kid got this sense that there was something wrong with them. And instead of just thinking, hey, loads of kids go through an Elsa phase, I know fully, very vanilla straight men who went through a phase of wearing eyeliner when they were teenagers. We should just be a bit more relaxed about that kind of stuff.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that was another thing I wanted to raise. Yes, I mean, the one great thing about the last, you know, several decades is that we have become, or we were getting to be, a lot more accommodating to different styles of being male and female. And that recognizing there's a huge spectrum in both sexes, and that it's fine, you know, that girls don't have to wear dresses or play with dolls to be real girls. And boys don't have to be aggressive or like to play war to be real boys. And that there's tremendous ways of, you know, of accommodating that and being comfortable with it. And the rise of trans activism in a way inhibits that, because then you say, well, if you're a very masculine little girl, a tomboy, I was one, that maybe you're a trans kid, you know, and vice versa. So that's worrying. I'm very glad you mentioned that. Now, there's one other thing I want to talk with you about, and that's the nature of puberty for the two sexes.
Okay.
So
I'm going to clarify that I'm not a developmental biologist, so please, you know, I did an English
degree.
Yeah, you've
studied this. Okay, you've studied this.
Don't take it with a pinch of salt.
This is not going to be biology. It's going to be just what one knows from experience and observation. And the fact is that for boys, most of the time, puberty is an enjoyable experience. They're getting bigger. They're getting stronger. They are now able to beat their sister at basketball when they never could before. Their voice is deepening. They're discovering girls or boys, usually girls. It's, you know, they're getting nocturnal emissions. All those things are kind of pleasant, okay? If somewhat embarrassing. For girls, puberty means suddenly having to deal with menstruation, suddenly having to deal with breasts, suddenly not knowing how to handle the sometimes and frequently unwanted attention of boys and older men, which girls go through. Puberty for girls is much more of a mixed bag than it is for boys. And so I'm not asking you to talk about biology, but just as a matter of just common sense, doesn't it seem that you would be more likely to see a certain reluctance to experience puberty on the part of girls, especially those who come from, you know, troubled backgrounds than you would expect to see among natal boys.
I think there's something to that. I don't want to downplay how hard puberty is and adolescence is for some boys, definitely. Because, you know, I think, you know, as you say, those things can be embarrassing. I think some boys find it, you know, then I think that the idea that people are now kind of afraid of them, I think they find quite weird the fact that they're now intimidating and that people kind of recoil from them or whatever it is. You know, for like young black men, they might now be on the radar of police. You know, if they're young Hispanic men, they now might not be swept up by the Trump administration because they got a tattoo for their autistic brother. You know, it's not that it's complications. But I think your fundamental thesis, which is that lots of girls find puberty really upsetting because their body changes in these ways that not just affect themselves, but how people around them look at them. And the idea that they now have to like live on their guard because they don't want to be giving off the wrong signals, and that you're somehow responsible for being young and attractive, and that you need to somehow kind of, you know, deal with this is a really, really heavy thing. As I say, Hadley Freeman wrote about this really beautifully in respect to anorexia in Good Girls, you know, about these girls who just want to please everybody around them, particularly, and not be a fuss. And the anxiety, you know, women have higher rates of anxiety and neuroticism, which I don't, you know, I think is not perhaps unreasonable when you think about the fact that you can't solve conflicts through violence. You have to negotiate your way out of things. And the other thing that's interesting is, actually, Bloxham Porter once interviewed a detransitioner, and she talked about what it was like to go on testosterone as a woman. And actually, if you talk to women who are on HRT, they're taking testosterone, they're often like, it's amazing, my libido's come back, and yes, I feel like I could just tell everyone to piss off. Right. So I think there is also a fact that, you know, that there is a kind of initial euphoria sometimes for people who go on these hormones, which they think is perhaps their gender being affirmed. It may just be that testosterone feels really great to be like horny and feisty and pissed off. Because we've heard those reports from lots of people, you know, people taking those hormones for other reasons.
Yes.
So yeah, I think again, you're right. Whereas, and then I think the converse thing happens, which is I think that some, you hear from older male transitioners who are tormented by their libido or tormented by their anger, actually, find the estrogen is sort of calming to them. There's a phrase which I will never be get out of my mind by one of the gender researchers who believes that people should be allowed to become eunuchs, you know, and believes that men should be able to be castrated. And he said the great thing about this is you can achieve what we call eunuch calm. Which is like something that,
I'm,
you know,
not
your
sure
meditation.
Too many people would sign up for that.
No, but I can totally see it. Why? For men who experience their sex drive as a kind of torment.
Yes.
Having that removed, I think, is a great relief too. Sorry, we've strayed into very strange areas, but
it's,
I think it's. I find this stuff completely fascinating because it's very hard to access what anyone else's, you know, brain or biochemistry tells them about the world and realize it's so different to your own.
Exactly. Okay, I want to close with just some thoughts though about the bind that parents are in. So, you know, parents love their children. They want the best for them. And they're, you know, a kid comes to them and says they're trans, and they may be skeptical, but they are so cross-pressured, right? Because the science, supposedly, at least in the United States, if they do some research, they'll find out that we're a bit of an outlier, but the American Pediatrics Association and the Endocrine Society and all of these groups that are supposed to provide good information say it's absolutely settled. The affirmative model of treating gender dysphoria is good science, it's good treatment, and it will help your child be happier. I view this as a huge failing on the part of the medical establishment. You?
I think you're right, because, you know, I was trying to think when you were saying that about how, you know, I think parents in that situation should react. And I think the one thing they should do is prioritize maintaining their relationship with their child, because all the evidence we do have says that kids who, you know, who have a loving and supportive and stable family environment, regardless of anything else, just do better. And so, but you're right. That is made more difficult by a society that is saying, if you don't instantly affirm, your parents hate you. And actually, maybe your school should be able to, you should be able to transition at school without your parents knowing if they're not sufficiently supportive. The only reason that a parent wouldn't instantly affirm you is because they're transphobic. Mm-hmm. And I think none of that is really helpful to what really is the best way to do it, which is for parents to say, let's be open-minded, let's keep a conversation going, you know, no surgery until you're, while you're still a minor. you know, but if you want to change your presentation in some ways, like that should be on the table and keep talking about it. But yeah, that's really difficult for parents to do when it's basically you're told to kind of like affirm or get off the bus. And that, I think you're right, that's medical malpractice, because at minimum, those medical associations in America should be conveying the sketchiness of the research and the fact that, as you say, whatever the conclusions we might eventually reach about puberty blockers, we don't have them yet. And so there is no one prescription of take this pill and your child will be happy again. And science sometimes needs to be upfront about what it doesn't know. Doctors need to be upfront about the fact they don't have all the solutions. And I think that's, I think it's been really cruel. I can see it's been done with the best of intentions, but I think it's tipped into a kind of messianic savior complex, which is something that I think when medicine goes bad, it can turn into, that's made it harder for parents who love their kids and would be happy with whatever flavor of child they end up in with in the end, but want to keep that conversation open throughout the really difficult period of their adolescence.
Well, on that, I will say thank you. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate you joining me, and I hope we can do this again sometime.
It's been very nice, but I'd be very happy to join you again, Mona. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, take care.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.